CMET Ontario work in a broader manner to ensure that the mental health lens is embedded across sectors at policy, health system, and program levels using a social determinants of health framework. Our network of 28 local branches and communities across the province provide us a strong capacity to mobilize with local partners. We manage several programs that support over 30,000 persons yearly, such as our Youth Campus Mental Health Program, our Talk Today program, which is a comprehensive mental health awareness initiative for amateur young athlete sports in Canada, our flagship cognitive behavior therapy principal programs, BondPack and Living Life to the Full, are accessible both at individual and community level. Living Life to the Full, your host program today, has successfully been adapted to the needs of different population. We have reached, with our program, youth, caregivers, people living on the autism spectrum, older adults, seniors, post-secondary students, and the Black communities. We are also we have also worked closely with several ethnocultural groups developing cultural and language adaptation. So far with Living Life to the Full, it is available in English, French, Cantonese, and Mandarin. And at the end of 2020, we will have it available in Tamil. So we will move on with Dr. Catrice's bio. Let me just change the... Dr. Catrice is a registered clinical psychologist, gerontologist, neuroscientist, and educator with over 15 years of professional experience. Dr. Catrice completed her clinical internship and CIHR-funded postdoctorate at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. From 2004 to 2012, she led the Mood and Related Disorders Clinic and funded the Cognitive Behavior Therapy Service at Baycrest Health Science. Since 2012, at the Rotman Research Institute, Baycrest and University of Toronto, she has studied the neural link between midlife depression and the development of dementia. She innovates treatments for depression and anxiety for older adults, including CBT, mindfulness, and exercise. Dr. Catrice's research has been funded continuously since 2006 and has been published in peer-reviewed academic journals, as well as book chapters. Dr. Catrice has completed over 400 presentations, serve as mental health advisors for Bell's Let's Talk, Girls E-Mentorship, Women's Brains Health Initiative, the Jane Goodall Foundation, and has been cited by CBC, CTV, The Globe and Mail, The Wall Street Journal, and 20 other media outlets. In 2013, she was awarded the Woman of Baycrest Innovators in Research Award, and in 2016, the Government of Ontario Leading Woman of Building Community Award for the enormous impact of her work as a psychologist and gerontologist at Baycrest. She is also a proud McGill alumni, and she is currently vice chair of the McGill's Women's Leadership and Philanthropy Committee. So without further delay, Dr. Catrice, the ball is on your side. Are you on mute here? You're not on mute for some reason. Give me a little minute here. Okay.
Good morning, everyone.
Now we're hearing you.
Wonderful. Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much, Ellen, for that very nice introduction. And it's a pleasure and an honor to be here to talk about valuing our elders and talking about how we need to creatively advocate for older adults during this time of of COVID-19. I'm most interested really in just your questions and, you know, for us to talk about both the difficulties, the challenges, and the opportunities during this time. And the outline, as you can see, is that we're going to be starting to talk about mental health for older adults. So talking about pandemic emotions and then talking about the impact of COVID-19 on older adults' brain health. Brain health is simply a combination of our sense of well-being, so our emotional health, and our cognitive health, our memory, our ability to think and function. And then lastly, we'll go over some tips about how to optimize brain health during this time for those of us who are older and caregivers of people who are older. Ellen, can we just kind of find out how many folks have joined us in the last couple of weeks, if they've joined any of the webinars so far?
I'll do this in a minute. Sorry, I just need to stop the share here. And I'll do this in a minute. Okay, so is anyone were there? Can you just send a little thumbs up for those who were there the last time?
Or
even before any other webinars we had, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yeah. 10, 11, we're almost 17, I'm counting here.
Okay. So it's approximately half and half. And so that gives me a sense of how much information to go over from other times. But essentially, as we have talked about in the last couple of weeks, we have a variety of emotions during this time. And that is okay. So there's no such thing as a right or wrong emotion. We have the emotions that we have. The important thing is to be able to name and acknowledge them. So some people are experiencing, you know, sadness during this time because of self-isolation, because of the uncertainty, because of health concerns, because of economic concerns. So this is the first time that there's been a global pandemic, so that absolutely everybody is going through the same thing at the same time. Maybe they don't experience the same emotions or it's not kind of hitting them the same way, but we're all in this together. And that means that we're not alone, but it also makes it challenging to move out of this situation, because usually there's parts of the world that are going through a crisis and parts that are not, so that they can come in and help. Whereas we're all kind of struggling with the same thing. And so I want to hear more in the Q&A about what the kind of struggles have been, especially in terms of being older or caring for someone older. So we're going to be talking about creative advocacy, one of which is just having this webinar now and talking about the issues and how we can value elders through this time. So studies show that people who can express more nuanced emotions or can acknowledge them have better mental health. So what does that mean? It means, you know, we could be feeling sadness, anger, loss, grief, frustration, anxiety, but knowing which emotion we're experiencing at any given time is important. So instead of trying to kind of shut it down and avoid our emotions or just acknowledging that we feel badly, it's important to understand what we feel so that we can kind of target those emotions specifically. So an example is if we're feeling anxious or more nervous than usual, then we know that we need to do something to help us relax. So maybe to exercise, to listen to music, to read a book, whatever it may be. So that's really, really key. Another thing that's very important is knowing when to seek help. So this is something that I've reviewed over the last couple of weeks, but I would like to review it again just because it's worth repeating. And also I'm going to talk about it a little bit differently this week. We're going to talk about what happens to older adults, which is my area of research, when they become distressed in their emotions. So there's a lot that we know from brain science, and I'm going to kind of bring that in right now and make it hopefully useful and accessible. So the, you know, most of the mental health problems are on a continuum, right? So it's not like, you know, you just turn off a light switch or turn it on and you're either mentally ill or you're mentally well. We're all on a spectrum all of the time. But it's true that 50% of Americans and 50% of Canadians believe that their mental health has suffered since the start of the pandemic, which makes a lot of sense. But I'm here to kind of, you know, give you support and explain to you when people should be seeking help or when they should be a bit more concerned about themselves, loved ones, people they're caring for. So I'm going to talk about depression and anxiety specifically because they make up 70 to 80% of all mental health problems on an outpatient basis. So all mental health problems, I just want to kind of make that clear, all mental disorders are actually just two things, okay? So they're a combination of feeling distressed, so too sad, too lonely, too nervous, whatever it may be, too angry, and then its impact on your functioning. So on the one hand, you have negative emotion that seems to be going on and feeling distressed, and the second part is it is impairing your functioning in two or more areas of life. So you're either having difficulty at work, in volunteering, in relationships, in other roles, like spousal roles, caregiving roles, whatever it may be. And so I'm going to kind of break down what happens to older adults and how they present differently than my younger clients and patients. So let's take depression first. When I see a 30-year-old, they're more likely to be crying, let's say if they're depressed. If they're not crying, they may be very kind of irritable or angry or just kind of exhausted. They're sort of seem burned out and they'll be saying that I just feel awful and I can't continue feeling this way. They will express a lot of distress directly to me. It'll be obvious that they feel down. When I see somebody who's 70 years old, let's say, there's a big difference in clinical presentation or the reason that they come to see me. Usually it's not that they think that they're depressed, it's that they think that they have cognitive impairment or dementia. What they will usually say is that they feel like they're losing their memory and they're very, very concerned about that. But the good news there is after I go through all the symptoms, if you feel that you or someone else is experiencing this, the best thing to do is get that checkup from the neck up and see a mental health professional, see your doctor, and you'll probably be relieved because it's more likely that that person has depression than they have dementia. So the number one brain health problem over the age of 35 or 40 is depression. It's not dementia. So let's start with depression. So depression is really three baskets of symptoms. And I'm going to talk about this differently than I have in the last couple of weeks. The thing that most likely, so there's three kind of baskets. What are they? One is emotional, second is physical, and the third is cognitive. But I'm going to start with the cognitive basket this week first, because that's what drives older adults into treatment for depression. So what are cognitive symptoms of depression? Things like not being able to pay attention, not being able to concentrate, not being able to make very small day-to-day decisions like what to eat, what to wear. Their social skills may be slipping. They may be losing their ability to plan. So obviously this is distressing to anyone. So if you're experiencing these symptoms and you're older, you may think, oh no, this is the start of a very bad situation, maybe cognitive impairment or dementia. But the truth is that cognitive impairment is a cardinal symptom of depression, no matter how old you are. So whether you're a child, an adolescent, a young adult, or an older adult, everybody to get the diagnosis of depression has some cognitive impairment, including things like negative distortions, like this feeling that nobody loves you. Even suicidal thoughts are actually a form of cognitive distortion or cognitive disruption. So it's important to keep that in mind. Now, as we age, so why am I starting with cognition? As we age, depression seems to have a greater cognitive edge. So it's not just in your head that you think that this is the most kind of salient symptom to you, that you're having cognitive problems, because that's what stands out. So, and then I developed treatments that kind of intervene with that, and I'll get to that in a moment. But just so you know that cognitive symptoms tend to predominate when people are older and they feel that they have depression. The second group of symptoms are sleep, appetite, and energy. So in terms of sleep, again, older adults may mistake what is actually a sign of depression with something that they've been told is okay. You know, as we age, our sleep becomes more disrupted and not as good, not as restful. Nobody should put up with sleep problems. Sleep problems are not a part of healthy aging. If you find that you have insomnia, so you can't sleep or you can't stay asleep, or you have hypersomnia, where it takes a lot to just stay awake throughout the day and you always feel exhausted, that is something in and of itself, whether you have low mood or not, that you need to see the doctor about. Everyone should be sleeping as an adult 7 to 9 hours a night. It's not true that we need less sleep as we get older. You just need the amount of sleep that you've always needed as an adult. And when you wake up in the morning, you should feel rested. If you don't, and this is ongoing for weeks and or longer, you should see your doctor. Second of all, in the physical basket of symptoms of depression, we have appetite. So there can be changes in appetite where somebody gains weight without trying because they're eating a lot of carbohydrate-rich foods for comfort or eating more. And or they may have the opposite. They may have no appetite at all and lose weight without trying. And then lastly, there's changes in energy. So a person may feel that everything is a physical effort and it's like they're walking through molasses, or they may feel the opposite, that they feel very agitated, they can't sit still, and it's sort of like they're run by a motor, but it's very unpleasant feeling. And then, so that's the physical basket of symptoms, sleep, appetite, and energy. And then the last one, which is the thing that people often notice first when they're younger, but last when they're older, is the emotional. So the stereotypical feeling down. And so when I'm working with older adults, I always focus on the cognitive first because they're more likely to talk about it. Whereas when I start with the emotional piece, they may say that they don't necessarily feel that down, or they maybe don't feel much. But not feeling much or feeling numb or like you can't feel is also very unhealthy. So that in a nutshell is depression. So if you're having those symptoms for a few weeks or more, most of the day, nearly every day, or you kind of can observe that in someone else to some extent, then it's really time to see a mental health professional or check in with your doctor. Now, another experience that people are having is the sense of kind of confinement and loneliness and feeling sort of a bit stir crazy because of the self-isolation that we've had to undergo because of the pandemic for several months. And of course, now this week, things are starting to open up in the greater Ontario area and in Toronto, but right, we've just kind of come through that. So everyone, I can assure you, is feeling more anxious than they have pre-pandemically. But you know, what's normal? But really, normal is a word we can retire for now. We want to think about what's adaptive and what's healthy. So it's okay to feel anxious. Again, it's important to acknowledge it, to name it, to talk to someone about it, and to understand when that is sort of tipping over into something clinical. So essentially, when people are clinically anxious, they're too nervous about things that other people wouldn't be as nervous about if they were in the same situation. And the other part of it is that it impairs their functioning. So they're so nervous that they can't do things that they need to get done just to kind of get through the day. And the last part is that when they're anxious because, you know, they realize, it's too late to make dinner. I guess I'm going to need to, you know, just have cereal for dinner. I'm going to need to get some takeout or something. You know, any one of us who kind of is feeling that they're in the face of even a small daily stressor might feel anxious for a few moments, but then you calm right down. What happens when you're clinically anxious is you don't. You get anxious and it feels like it's just cumulative. Every stressor in the day just makes you more anxious, and the next day it just starts again. So no one needs to put up with being so anxious. And older adults have what we call comorbidity, which means to have more than one disorder at the same time. So 50% of people who meet the criteria for depression also meet the criteria for anxiety. So it's important to just be aware of that. And it's kind of a bit of a chicken or the eggs, you know, which thing started first. But everyone kind of has their own, health signature, mental health signature, that when they start to get stressed, they start to get revved up, they start to get anxious, they start to run around. Some people start to shut down right away and feel overwhelmed and paralyzed. So, you know, or something in between. So it's important to understand what you're going through and to be able to seek help at the appropriate time. So let's now talk a little bit more about why it's important to value elders during this time and their brain health. It's key for a lot of reasons, but the main reason is a lot of the deaths associated with COVID-19 have really come from long-term care. So this has been a tragedy for many people, but it's also been a stressor, even if you haven't been touched by that kind of tragedy, because so many of us are caregivers. So, you know, about 80% at least, I'm sure it's higher, of caregiving in Canada is done informally by family members. And 2/3 of them are women. We know that caregiving is depressogenic, which means that being a caregiver, whether it's for children or for somebody who's older or somebody who's a spouse, all they're kind of things that can overwhelm a person. So even though caregiving can be very meaningful, it can bring us closer, it can be very kind of deepening, it can also be kind, you know, very exhausting physically, financially, emotionally. Many caregivers are, I mean, the average, sort of the snapshot of a caregiver is a 50-year-old woman who's working full-time and who has children that haven't launched yet. So that's a lot. That's a lot to go through. And even if you don't fit into that specific category, you know what I mean, that caregivers are under a lot of pressure all the time. Now, what happens when you add a pandemic to it is it's what we call kind of, caregiving out of touch, in the sense that you want to be in touch emotionally, but you may also need to be there in person to make sure someone has groceries, to make sure they take their medication, to help them physically. And during this time, what I hear the most about from clients and patients and other groups that I advise, organizations that work with caregivers, is that it's been an enormous stress, which it would be, to try and look in on someone, to be connected with them, whether they're living in the community or they're in long-term care, because we've been forced to self-isolate, which we need to do because it's a health pandemic and we need to take public health measures. But that doesn't take away the strain and the anxiety and the sadness that a lot of people are experiencing right now. So I think it's important just to acknowledge that. So as I said at the beginning, this is about creative advocacy. How can we advocate for a loved ones and people that we're caregiving for in a paid way or an unpaid way in society in Canada while this is going on? So it's important to be able to connect in the ways that we can. So what does that mean? So trying to connect through phone calls, through sending music, art, jokes, what we're doing now, this sort of idea of Zoom interfacing, having family members be able to talk to them, you know, things like that. So we have to be creative and do what we can. I also think that this is a very important time when people, you know, they're not maybe feeling empowered as they might when they can crystallize and come together as caregivers, but this is a good time to take notes. This is a good time to journal and write down not only your experiences, because research shows that when we write down our feelings, we feel better. When we write down our thoughts, we think more clearly, whether we do anything to solve the problem or not. So it's really, really important to keep track of what you've experienced, because that experience can inform advocacy after this, after things reopen completely. So this is not though it's a tough time, it doesn't have to be time where nothing gets done in terms of this. So I'm not trying to add to people's caregiver burden or anything like that. I'm just trying to say that it's both helpful for you as a human being, and it's helpful to the people that we're serving and taking care of and caregiving for. So to kind of not let go of that, of that advocacy line as we're going through this. It's also an important time to reach out, whether you're going to write a letter to politicians or to the media or to researchers, clinicians, because we're all part of advocacy. Whether we're doing research with older adults, whether we're treating them clinically, whether we're helping them informally, whether they're parts of our family and friends, which is kind of true for most people, it's important to communicate what you're seeing and kind of keep at it. And I know that that's difficult, but I think we need to keep hope, because it's easy to lose optimism in a time like this, but I think we need to hold on to the hope, because optimism is doing something because you think it's going to turn out well, which is what we often do in good times. But right now we need something else. We need hope, which is doing something because it's worthwhile no matter how it turns out. So we need to be, you know, physically distanced, but let's not be morally distant or emotionally distant. We need to sort of keep on going and keeping on connecting. Now, I want to move back and kind of end off by talking about why, especially in the caregiver group, which is all of us, because really either you've been a caregiver, you are a caregiver, or you're going to become a caregiver. So everybody is in the same boat, just not at the same time. And I think it's important to understand how mental health and cognitive health link. And by that, I mean that people, we know from research that people who have an untreated history of depression in midlife, so they didn't get assessed, they didn't get treated. Let's just put this in the caregiver framework, because it's too much to really do anything for themselves, because they have so many other responsibilities. And so they often are sort of last on the list, and they don't, let's say, seek treatment, even though they may have depression or anxiety. So untreated depression and anxiety doubles that person's chance of developing dementia later on compared to people who don't have that untreated history. So it's very important to get the checkup from the neck up and save your mental health as a caregiver or as anybody in midlife, because you're saving your emotional health today, your mental health, by doing that. But you're also staving off dementia. You're saving your cognitive health later on. The other key is we have wonderful treatments for depression and anxiety. We have medications that work. We have evidence-based talk therapies that work. We have combination treatments. We have mindfulness. We have exercise. We have lots and lots of roads to recovery and wellness that keep us well. But at the moment, dementia is incurable. So as a researcher, as a scientist, and in my case, as a clinician scientist, we never want to see anybody go down that awful cognitive road. We want people to be well, enjoy life, be able to you know, complete their responsibilities and have meaning and richness, and to stay healthy into the future. So that's kind of very, very important. And so that's why I kind of stress the idea of cognition and emotional health. So together, brain health, keeping emotionally healthy now, so that we can have cognitive health later on and now. Now, let me kind of just end off with talking about tips for coping. So I said talking to someone, but what does that really mean? Let's keep the conversation. Let's start a conversation if we haven't, and let's keep it going. Studies show that in North America, compared to 30 years ago, people are like 40%, so double what it was 30 years ago, percent of people say that they have no confidant, no one to tell their troubles to. So if the pandemic is doing anything, it's teaching us that we need each other. So this is a good time to develop a relationship, a confidant relationship, if you don't have one. It's important to talk about the stress that you're experiencing, whether it's COVID-19 related or not, with all the changes and disruptions that we're all going through. So talking to someone can be talking to a friend. There's hotlines, if there's no one else that you can think of to talk to. Family members, the number is 211 to get mental health help quickly in Ontario. There's kids' help phones. I mean, if people are thinking about their children or grandchildren, it could be somebody who's a counselor, somebody who's a mentor, someone you went to school with, someone in your faith community. It could be anyone, and it can also be your doctor or your mental health professional. But it's important to be able to speak completely openly with someone and confidentially about what you're going through. It's important to keep a regular schedule. So it's very difficult, especially I'm kind of staying with the caregiver role here, to take care of ourselves when we're taking care of others. But it's important to remember that self-care is selfless. If we can't care for ourselves, how can we care for others? And so easy to say, hard to do, I know, because this is the area I work in. But still, you know, we need to get up at the same time every day, sleep at the same time, have regular meals. And if we can't do all that, because I know it's a tall order, then try to kind of edit. I'll give an example. So with eating, you know, try to just stock the pantry and the fridge with things that are relatively healthy and simple to prepare. And so you're just going to eat whatever is there. So one silver lining of the pandemic is people don't shop as often. So when you shop, try and be good to yourself and pick the things that make sense for a healthy diet. And when it's time to snack, pick something with one ingredient, like, you know, apples just have apples, nuts just have nuts. And this easy thing to do is, you know, try to keep it simple. I mentioned this earlier, but journaling is really important. And so is making a plan. So because caregiving is changing, it's important to sit down at some point and think about who can do what. Don't be afraid to reach out and ask for help. At the most, the person can just say no. You don't have to keep. I think one of the problems with the pandemic is that people have such high expectations. They're putting so much pressure on themselves. They're trying to perform to the level that they were pre-pandemically, but that's just not realistic. I think we all need to give ourselves a break and lower our expectations. So when it comes to caregiving, sitting down and making a plan and saying, look, I can't do all these things. Who can do them? And it's important to communicate with everyone, including the person you're caregiving for, if they can, and depending on what the caregiving scenario is, if they can understand and you can communicate with them about what you can and can't do, and try and get other things in place so that you can sort of sustain your level of activity. So we don't want people to completely burn out. So lowering expectations is important, being kind, cutting other people some slack, cutting yourself some slack. And, you know, it's also important to help yourself to relax. So whether it's prayer, mindfulness, yoga, watering the plants, listening to music, meditating, it's really, really important to take a break. And so what I mean by that is studies show that even taking 3 minutes a day helps your mental health and your physical health and your cognitive health. So one thing that's changed for me is that, you know, normally I'd be with all of you, which is what I would want. I would want to have us all be in a room together. And one of the things I always try to do is to do an exercise together before we, you know, leave the talk. And Ellen knows about this is, you know, doing a mindfulness exercise where I teach people to deep breathe correctly. And we do it for maybe 2 minutes tops, because we don't want to take away, I guess, time from trying to transfer all this information and take questions and things. And in that time, invariably, 90% of people will say that they're, because I've been doing this for 15 years, about 90% of people will say that their anxiety or their low, you know, mood or their stress basically has dropped by about an average of 30%. And that's just 2 minutes of your day. And so that's something I think we can all do, even if it means just doing it before you're going to sleep. Another thing that's really important is to practice gratitude, I think. So this is something I do now because I teach it. So you got to walk the walk. And I write down 3 things I'm grateful for in that specific day at the end of the day. And I read that in research that this makes people feel better and it helps their well-being. And I thought, well, you know, easy enough, I'll try it out. And it really does work. It does kind of move your mind to the good things of the day. And it shifts your perspective. And that's important. So as difficult as this time is, it's not as difficult for us in Canada as it is for people in countries where things were, you know, much more poverty stricken, not the same kind of healthcare, all kinds of political unrest. I mean, all kinds of things that people are experiencing and have been experiencing pre-pandemically and will continue to struggle with even post-pandemically. So it's important to be grateful for what we have as a as Canadians, what we have in our communities, as families, as communities, and really dwell on that. I think that's important. And then lastly, it's important to just do what you can where you are. As I mentioned, it's a good time to lower expectations, kind of take a breath, and just know that this is a very, very unusual situation, to the point that it's unprecedented even in all of human history. So we're all doing what we can do. And it's always a pleasure and honor to be here with CMHA. I'm happy to help out anytime I can and to continue the conversation. But right now I'm going to turn it over to everyone who's taken the time. And I want to thank everyone for listening. And now Ellen, maybe let's open it up for questions and let's find out what's on everyone's minds.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Nazrin. It's always nice to be in your company. I already have a very interesting question here. And please keep sending your comment and questions. We have a good 22 minutes of question and answer. So please send your questions and comments to me through the chat room. This question says, I'm wondering about Zoom session for mental health geriatric clients. Yeah. My recent experience has been that they seem overwhelmed with Zoom FaceTime sessions with family members, seeing their family but not being able to interact through touch can be confusing for them. Wondering if it's really that helpful or is just causing more stress.
So that's an important point, is that, you know, Zoom, is it helping or not? I would say overall, it's on an individual basis, and it can change even day to day. So it's important, I think, Ellen, for people to do what works for them, but to stay in touch in a way that the person you're trying to reach can tolerate and can gain something from. So I think it's important to keep on communicating about what's working and what isn't working.
This questions remind me of, and if I may, I'll share a little anecdotal experience with my dad, who's 90 years old. And my dad is still very active, but of course, not being able to go out twice a day like he used to has been a bit affecting him. And above all this, his telephone line was, for some reason, connected to 911. So every time we wanted to call him, 911 was answering. And this was like very confusing. And so anyway, all this to say that Bell Canada was not able to go in the old age home where he lived. So the poor man ended up without his telephone line for 2-3 months almost now. So we brought him a cell phone, like a very basic one. And like the stress that this created to him to just learn how to do 2-3 steps to call us or answer a phone call from us has been like tremendous, really. And for Father Day, I called him, and my dad is a man of, when we're with him in person, he's the life of the party, but on the phone is a man of a few words, basically. And during the Father Day's phone call, he talked to me about 40 minutes, and he was so happy that finally he had his landlines. So some people, it does really create stress, technology for some older seniors. And I think it's very important to recognize that, you know, it's, but he was certainly a very happy camper with his brand new landline phone, basically. Right. Just an anecdote here.
Yeah, I just want to, can I just say something about that. That's what I meant by lowering expectations. I mean, he did wonderfully, and that's a very nice story. But I think we have to accept the fact that having to adjust, whether it's technology or something else, during the pandemic is in and of itself a part-time job. So we don't have to pretend that this isn't really difficult. You know, it's resilient people don't just plow through everything. Resilient people know when to take a rest, take a step back, and when to lower expectations. So it's really important to know that we're doing a lot of work, even if we feel that we're less productive, because we're working around so many other things that have changed.
My brother went about at least 3-4 times, him on his balcony, trying to teach him the new phone, how he can use it. So finally found somebody, a nice PSW again, who was able to teach him how to use it properly. And anyway, this gives a sense of the barriers. I mean, for some of us, it's very simple, but there's a lot of barriers.
I think there's someone has their hand up there.
I see that. Now, listen, I'm not too sure. I don't see your question here. So you send the Zoom question. Just send me the question through the, and I'll be sharing it, okay? Because I have quite a few of them coming in right now. So are you familiar with any training programs for volunteers seeking to support seniors in community over the phone?
Yes. In fact, we have just such a program at Baycrest. So if you call Baycrest and go through their volunteer department, they actually have, I can't remember, it has a very catchy title, the name of the program, but essentially it's, where people, volunteers call seniors in the community over the phone, and they're kind of given someone specifically, and then they follow up with that person weekly or however often it is. So yes, please, we're always looking for volunteers.
Yeah, they always call it friendly visitors in normal time, but now it's friendly phone friends, I guess, from PAL. Yeah, there's quite a few community agencies that have such programs. So 211 will, whoever asked this question, 211, if you call 211 and ask for such program or be connected to such program for the person you care for or just for you, please, they'll give you various agencies that have such programs in your neighborhood, okay? So don't hesitate, call 211. I'm sure they'll share this information to you. Okay, so how to help my relative who is an elder, 70 years old, to deal with the possible employment change from working to not working because of the higher risk of working with the public during the pandemic, but not having anything else to do with their time, and so not being ready to leave employment. Wow, somebody who wants to continue working is no longer able to work and is like, how can we help them, right, this kind of people that are so active normally?
Right, but this is actually a very universal issue because one of the main things that people, you know, when it comes to retirement planning, the only thing you hear about, I know the question is about somebody who is kind of taken by surprise by this turn of events, but let me just talk about retirement in general. We need to do social planning. The only kind of retirement planning you hear about is financial. And of course that's important, but it's necessary, but not sufficient. The main thing after that is how you are going to find meaning, stay connected, have pleasure and a sense of mastery in your life. And so I think it's never too early and never too late to start that. So I think with this individual, it's good to sit down and make a plan about things they would like to do, things that they wanted to do when they were working but didn't have the time, or how can they do the thing they were doing sort of when they were working, how can they kind of do that in a non-employed capacity? So let's just say they were working in, in an office or working in food services or working somewhere. How can they carry that interest into their retirement life? So again, time to lower expectations and understand that everybody has to adjust. In terms of retirement, it takes a while. It's not something, we always see the ads where this is a huge relief and one minute you're kind of, you know, working really hard and next minute you're golfing and you love it and you kind of are going into the sunset, but that's just not realistic. People still want to be vital. They want to feel needed and to do something and actually contribute. So more people, when you look at studies and surveys, want to do that than lay on the beach after a certain amount of time. So what you can do is say that, you know, right now, this person who has this sort of unplanned retirement can, you know, take it easy, do a few more leisure activities. But while they're doing that, to think about other things they might want to do, whether it's volunteering, continuing their work, but in a different way, or, you know, planning new activities.
Yes, and I would add to this that your volunteer center of any city, like in each city in Canada, you have a volunteer center. It's a good place to start to really browse what's available in volunteering. There's so many things like community kitchen, there's all kinds of things that we can't even figure out, like that we thought we would not even exist. The person can sit on board of director, all kinds of things that can be done with volunteering. But the place to really connect yourself for that is really your local volunteer centers. And they usually help you. They take a look at your interest and so on and try to match you to the appropriate volunteer job or volunteer involvement. Okay, so let's move on because I've got quite a few of interesting questions here. How can I help a senior family member to stay connected if he is rejecting the help, not answering the phone as an example? So I suppose the person is isolating themselves more and more.
Right, I think it's when things become a little bit more difficult, it's stressful for everyone. I think you may want to involve someone else. So you may want to involve the person's doctor. In terms of the first kind of, if there's a theme today, it's communication. So it's just communicating with someone to make sure that you're able to handle the stress and talk to someone and confide in them about what's happening. So you may get some support, but also some problem solving help about what they can do, because I don't know everything about the situation. If you can't reach them that way, can you leave something for them at their door? You know, so that, the example would be that you would be organizing groceries for them. So can you leave that there and then, write them a note and put it in the mailbox, or leave them a message on their phone saying that you needed to talk to them? Can you have some other community agency involved? So same kind of thing as Ellen was saying earlier, that every city has somebody you can call for that kind of thing in terms of what to do next to keep somebody safe.
Absolutely. Somebody here is saying, sometimes with elders, it takes much more time to connect with new technology, but it's worth it. If I may just mention a few experiences we had with our Enriches project, which is unfortunately finished, but we've been running this project for the last almost 4.5 years with various partners. And we had a number of technology, learning new technology programs within the Enriches initiative. And whoever said that, she's very right. It takes a bit of time, it takes some support, but once the person really know what to do, it's really enhancing people's life. And we've seen people as old as 95 years old learning how to use a tablet. And it's feasible. It's just a matter of finding a good agencies that have such kind of program. It's that we're seeing more and more agency having these kinds of programs, but it's not always easy to find, but so not sure what you want. Would you like to add anything, Nazlin, on this one?
No, I think that's absolutely right. If it takes longer, that's okay. And I like the tone of the message. It's kind of the right one, that it may take a little bit longer, but, you know, it's always worth it. And I've seen the same thing where I've seen people over 95 during this time, learning new technology. And that's good. It's a learning curve.
Absolutely. Another question, I guess I am seeking consulting to help recreate such a program in my community to our senior serving organization. We live in a small rural community in Renfrew County. Now, I'm not too sure what you mean by such a program. So can you please give me some clarification on this, and we'll come back to your question if it's possible. And then we'll move on to another one. Are we projecting more of our needs into our elderly with regards to connection? Their life experience may have already included family separation, different countries, long time between connections, long distance phone cost. Therefore, with our reliance on current technology and transportation, it is us that are getting more anxious. And as parents, they take on our problems. What a wonderful comment. What do you think of that?
I think that's really interesting. And I'm sure that's true for some people, that they're more anxious maybe than the elders that they're caring for. But nonetheless, whether it's because we've grown up with technology and expect more from communication and having things, doing things instantly and not being separated from people, and being able to tolerate that. But I think that it's still better to be connected than not. So, but it is a good point to understand that just because you're experiencing distress, it doesn't mean that the person who is receiving caregiving is feeling the same way that you do. But again, I think that communication is key, and to check in with people and see how they really feel about the situation they're in. So thank you for that.
We have here another great comment. As a family friend who is a POA for personal care, mm-hmm. for someone who was diagnosed with dementia who lives alone, it's been challenging for me to advocate for their mental and physical well-being because the person is unwilling to share what they are experiencing with the small circle of friends that's supporting. And speaking with the LINS and care agency's coordinator, they are limited to what they can do to help, since many at-home services are limited during this time. What can we do for this person's well-being? And it speaks also to people. I'm in this situation. I have a friend who's not doing very well. She has nobody really but me, but I'm not someone who can go and talk on her behalf to somebody, because she's considered an adult with her own, with her capacity to make decision, and she's screaming for someone to help her. She feels she's not. So how do we do this? Like, how right. do we?
I think one thing is, because things are opening up now, is to be able to, if you can, accompany that person to an appointment where they can connect with the kind of help that they need. So I understand, whether you have power of attorney with someone about their health, or even if you don't, it's still difficult in real life to make these connections and get people the help that they need. So maybe trying to do it in a less forceful, more kind of informal way, and just offering the company, offering the assistance by actually going with the person.
Yeah, trying to find ways to at least introduce you to some care person of some kind, to let them know that, hey, I'm here if you need any assistance. I'm here to assist my friend, and I can be a good resource person for you in the care of that person, I suppose. Because right. I mean, I guess the medical team understand that some people are really alone in life,
Yeah.
So it's not an easy answer for this question.
But it's an increasingly important answer, because 1/3 of Canadians live alone, and so not all of them are older adults, but the point is that's the direction that we're going in. There's many parts, many cities around the world where 50% of people live alone. And Toronto's coming close to that. So it's actually the most popular household setup. So if that's the case, and as people age, as most developed countries are aging, we need to have an answer for this. We can't just let people float.
Absolutely, and we have seen with the EnRiches projects, we had broadened quite a lot our definition of caregivers. And we've seen like models of caregiving mostly in certain building, for instance, where three older ladies fairly alone in life supporting each other and helping each other going they were sort of creating a unit of support. And in some environments, they were also harassed by some people who saw their vulnerability. And because of that, they sort of gathered together to better support each other. And we thought this kind of model of caregiving was really an amazing way to help people in isolation.
Yeah, I think it's going to take more. I think it's going to take social policy changes at some point, because this is the very kind of structure of society has changed so much.
Absolutely. So let's move on. I have a few other interesting questions. Okay, so the lady about the program, she was saying the question was about consulting, was regarding organizing and offering a training to community volunteers for a phone support program. So mostly, I think she's interested in organizing or creating such program in their neighborhood. Not too sure what you have to answer to this.
Is there something through the CMHA where people can kind of like train the trainer models? Do you have anything like that?
We don't have to train the trainer models for this kind of program. I'm just trying to think who. Certainly the volunteer center of your local or the nearest town where you live could probably be a good place to have a starter conversation on that. They do help organization on how to manage volunteers, how to put together a good group of volunteers for various programs. And the other thing would be that to identify an agency that has been doing this for a long time and call them and pick their brain, to replicate their model.
Right. I mean, the only thing I can think of is maybe calling Baycrest and talking to their volunteer department. Not for you to volunteer, but to learn more about how to roll out these programs. But I think that's wonderful, and I really hope that you're able to get that off the ground.
Yeah, and again, you may want to take a look at 211 to identify an agency that is probably close to the kind of work you're doing and see how you can find a group of people who's been doing this somewhere and can help you build the components of a good program, basically. Right. Policies around those programs as well. There's lots of got to be careful with police checks and that kind of thing. So, all right. Okay, let me see here. I could not take semi-retirement before retiring in normal time due to the nature of the job. This pandemic gave me a sense of what semi-retirement feels like, even with restriction, not being able to travel, etc. It won't be such a big adjustment when I do enter. Oops, just lost it. Sorry. Where are you? It won't be such a big adjustment when I do enter full retirement. So it's a bit of a silver lining. So again, someone who's sort of taking, see this pandemic half full more than half empty, which is a good.
That's really a wonderful comment. And I hope that, I mean, we can all kind of learn from that, which is to try out a different kind of lifestyle or a lifestyle that, you know, you may be living even years from now, but it's good to make use of the time and try to kind of try different ways of living.
Yes, absolutely. We have another question here. What if the person doesn't accept or believe they have a mental health challenge? God, this is such a hard, hard situation for many caregivers, actually.
It really is. And I think that here, you know, we don't want to get into a power struggle. I think the label isn't the most important thing. It's, we can just skip over that and say, you know, that's fine that you don't think that you have that challenge, but this is kind of what I see. So I think it's important to be able to sit the person down in a kind, gentle, private way when tempers aren't sort of flaring, and talk about, you know, ask permission from the person, you know, can I talk about the kinds of things I'm seeing without naming it as a mental health challenge necessarily. So this is how I see, you know, something about your behavior or your functioning, not in a blaming way, but in a kind of objective, specific, concrete way. So for example, for someone who's depressed. So what I'm noticing is that you don't get out of bed until noon, or you have a lot of trouble getting out of bed. Does that, you know, is that true? Does that make sense to you? So just focusing on what you're seeing as the symptoms or the behaviors and saying, you know, wouldn't it be helpful for you to feel like you have more energy or you want to get out of bed in the morning, because it's not always been like this. And then, you know, again, kind of accompanying them to the doctor and in trying to kind of nudge and influence them in a positive way and in a gentle way, because it's not important to label people. It's important for people to be well, no matter how they label themselves. So I think that's what you want to do, is kind of get underneath the problem and support the person in the way that they can tolerate.
Yes, and the fear as well. Maybe address some of the fear. Yeah. People may be very fearful.
Anxious. There's a lot. There's still, you know, we say there isn't, but there is a lot of stigma about brain health problems, whether it's depression, dementia, whatever it may be. And so it's okay to say, you know, I think if I was experiencing what you're experiencing and feeling like I couldn't get out of bed, I'd be really scared. I mean, I don't know how you feel. So opening the door for people to be able to express their unique experience of what's happening, you know, and being able to really listen, you know, give yourself a lot of time with this person on different occasions and listen so that others will talk.
And also create a safe space. We do this a lot in living life to the full, and people, because they know they're safe, they open up a lot more. So it's always good to do, I suppose. I have a last question here. What did Dr. K, it's probably you, Dr. Katri, means last week by not believing in what normal means, since there is a lot of stigma around mental health? So that notion of...
Right. So I think what I said is that we can retire the word normal, but what I really meant is not so much in terms of mental health, although that too, you know... it's really more about, during the pandemic time, people keep saying in the media and to one another, the new normal. And I think they're trying to be kind and say that, you know, one day it'll go back to where it is and try to be reassuring. But the reality is it probably makes people more anxious, because it makes it seem like what we're going through is abnormal. I mean, of course it's abnormal from the way we see it. But instead of thinking about, you know, when will it be the same again, I think we need to just look towards a new future. So instead of the new normal, I like to say new future. That's all. It's just a way that I feel like people can accept that there's been changes, some of which may not go back. So I'm not saying that people, so does that make sense? And I think it's important to be adaptive and healthy. So I'm trying to use terms that I think are more useful. That's all.
Yes, and it's, you know, there's terms like resiliency, nimbleness, the capacity to just move with the flow, you know,
because actually, if I can just jump in, we are in, that's the word, we are in a very fluid situation right now. things are changing. Things are reopening in other parts of the world and the country, they're closing. Things are, you know, we need to be emotionally agile. We need to be able to adjust, adapt, and still thrive.
Absolutely, and it's really about also naming, okay, this part, I'm flowing with it. But this one, I'm having a lot of difficulties and I'm probably gonna have to seek more support. So it's not like we're doing everything, it's not that like the whole thing is affecting us across, right? It's really, it depends which aspect of the new situation, I suppose. Mm-hmm. All right, so unless a last call, someone just sent.
Okay.
So I have a last question. This is really the last one. My mother, who is in the long-term care home, has a mantra. Go with the flow. Her attitude has really helped her.
Wonderful. Yeah. Go with the flow.
Yeah.
And it's a good note to end on.
Yeah, and somebody is wise around here. And, you know, in living life to the full, we say energy flows where attention goes, meaning that whatever you focus on, amplified, right?
So wonderful.
Yeah.
Energy flows where attention goes.
Yeah, so in other words, what you focus on, amplify, right? So yeah. Might as well focus on something fun and enjoyable.
Right.
So I will leave you on these word of wisdom, I guess, right? And we'll see you again next week for those who are interested in post-pandemic discussion. What is it that we have ahead in the post-pandemic discussion? And I would like to wish you a great week. Stay safe, everyone, and have a good time. It's such beautiful summer so far. So but be out there, but in a safe way, okay? So have a good week, everyone.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you, Nazrin. It was, again,
always a pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
Take care.